excited! Your first Ouija board.
Okay, so what do I do? Just ask it a question?
Yes, anything.
Oh, spirits from beyond, am I destined to find love?
P-R-O-B.
It's trying to spell probably.
N-O-T.
Did it just tell me probably not and then abbreviate it? What the hell? Let's go get a magic eight ball.
The Ouija board's been confounding Americans for more than 100 years, starting with how to pronounce it. Later in the show, we'll talk about how it's outlived most other 19th century board games and is now the subject of a new horror film. But first, a doctor in New York City has the Ebola virus. Dr. Craig Spencer had been treating Ebola patients in Guinea with Doctors Without Borders before returning to the city last week. He is the ninth patient to be treated for Ebola in the United States since the epidemic in West Africa began. And so far, just one person has died here. But in West Africa, about 5,000 people have died so far. Gina Moore has been reporting on the crisis from Liberia for BuzzFeed. Her latest story is about what happens to the people who survive the disease. Hi, Gina.
Hi.
So about 30%, the WHO, World Health Organization, estimates survive the disease. And you write about the case of one man in particular, Isaac, who lives in Dolo Town in Liberia. And you start your piece with this line: Isaac is a man who has lost literally everything. And at first, I thought you were playing pretty loose with the word literally, but then it actually turns out that he did lose every single thing that he owned, and he lost every single member of his family to Ebola. Can you tell us how it started for him?
His story is in so many ways like the thousands of stories of people who have got the disease here. The disease came through his wife. She contracted the disease from her mother, who contracted it from her father, and it goes on like that because this is passed from person to person, and it's usually passed when people are caring for each other. You get Ebola, and it's probably worth emphasizing that the only way to get Ebola is from contact with bodily fluids of symptomatic, which is to say very infectious patients. And most of the people who are going to have that kind of exposure to those kinds of fluids are caregivers, especially in rural Liberia, where right now most hospitals and clinics are closed. The ones that are open, if you start to show anything they think of as an Ebola symptom, they're going to run you right out of there as quickly as possible because they're afraid. And they're also lacking a lot of the kinds of equipment and basic supplies that they need to take care of such people safely. And that's what happened to Isaac's wife. She was pregnant at the time she got infected. Her mother had died. Her mother died in her lap, as a matter of fact. And then she fell ill. She miscarried, which is incredibly common for women who are pregnant and have Ebola. Isaac took her to the clinic, and then she started to vomit, which is the classic famous symptom of Ebola here. That's the thing that starts to freak everybody out. And they sent her home, and that's where she died. And a week later, her son, their three-year-old son, died too.
Mm. And then when she was in the hospital, the people there, or the clinic where she was, they told Isaac that he had to clean up his wife's blood as they were leaving.
Yeah, that's because of the same thing we were just saying, really, that blood is one of those bodily fluids that's highly contaminated if you're very symptomatic. And you can sort of eyeball a patient who you suspect of having Ebola for very symptomatic. They're doing things like running a really high fever or vomiting. And so the healthcare professionals, the healthcare givers in this clinic knew, oh my goodness, this is not a good sign. And they were exposed, were afraid to be exposed to those fluids. Isaac, having brought his wife there, bleeding already, having had to take her home while she's bleeding, to a certain extent, you know, would have the exposure. So they asked him to take care of it.
Hmm. So, of course, then he fell ill. And what did he tell you about those 8 days that he was sick with Ebola?
So he spent 8 days in an Ebola treatment unit, an Ebola treatment ward, an ETU, we call them out here. But essentially, it's a clinic, it's a tent, really, where Ebola patients go for treatment, which is largely about staying hydrated and trying to stay clean and just waiting out this virus. And those 8 days that he spent in the Ebola treatment center, he doesn't actually have so much to say about them, because he was incredibly weak and it was a bit of a waiting game. Was he going to make it, or was the virus going to overwhelm his body? The days before, when he first started getting really sick at home, they were really hard for him, because not only had he seen his wife and his son die of the same thing, so he recognized what was happening to him and he knew how it had ended for them, but no neighbors, no friends, no one wanted to come around and really help him because they were afraid of him too. It was finally his sister who persuaded an ambulance to come and pick him up and take him for treatment about 2 hours away here in the capital of Monrovia, is where a lot of the Ebola treatment beds are. And so it was 8 days later that he actually became free of the virus.
So he goes back home and he's free of the virus, and therefore he can't pass it on to others. And yet he's shunned, right, by his neighbors and his friends.
That's right. And that's so common for survivors here. We're seeing more survivors than we've seen before. That's partly because people are getting to treatment centers earlier with better knowledge about what's going on. That's partly because there are more beds at all for people to be treated in. 2 months ago, people would wait and wait and wait and wait outside of treatment clinics hoping for a bed to open up. That's not the case anymore. So there are a lot of things that have changed that make it easier to get to sick people faster, and when you get sick people faster, they have a much better chance of surviving. But when they come home, all of them talk about facing this stigma. Although they've survived, everyone's afraid of them. They shun them. They call them Ebola man or Ebola woman, or he lives in that Ebola house. And there's still just a lot of fear about the disease, and that's one of the ways it gets expressed, even though scientists understand that having survived it, you've become immune. So it's a great and rather terrible irony.
Right. And then he had to get rid of all his possessions because they might be infected or contaminated.
Yeah. If you have Ebola, everything you touch is sort of virus suspect, especially clothes, cloth, bed sheets, pillows, you know, things that you probably sweat in, that kind of thing. But for safety's sake, everything is treated as if it too has Ebola. And what you have to do is basically spray it down, drag it out of your house, and light it on fire. That's the only way to deal with the risk that might be present in the things. Well, it's a guy like Isaac, who's like a lot of the people here in general, but especially a lot of the Ebola survivors, that's pretty much the end of everything you have. For most of the rural poor here, and that's a lot of the population, there aren't bank accounts, there aren't savings accounts. You put the money you earn into the things that your family needs to survive. And so, you know, your IRA is your kitchen table. And that's, and with that, with everything else, that's what Isaac had to burn.
So no furniture, no bed, no clothes, mm-hmm. not even knives and forks. Mm-hmm. All of it burned.
Yeah, all of it gone. Even the soccer posters that he used to hang on, that he had hanging on his wall. There's a kind of almost aesthetic here in West Africa, where a bank will give out a calendar with a big picture, or a soccer team have a calendar, and people will have 5-, 6-, 7-year-old yearly calendars on their wall just because they like the picture of the person or the event being depicted. All of that gone, gone, gone. And he hasn't been back to the home. He's now in a room at his little brother's house. And to have to rely as the older brother and the strong man and the family man, to have to rely on your little brother in the culture here is a really, really, really difficult thing for a man to do.
But there is a ray of hope. There's a small organization that you talk about that's been trying to help survivors reintegrate with their communities. Tell us what they're doing.
The Carter Center on Mental Health is a program that's actually a part of the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia. And they have, over the years here, been training health practitioners, medically trained health practitioners of varying stripes, to be mental health workers. And those mental health workers have come together and said, okay, let's see how we can support these people as they're going home and dealing with this kind of stigma. So they're starting these outreach groups that are going to meet for about 10 weeks where survivors will speak together and try to brainstorm about what to do about this problem. How can they rebuild relationships with their friends and neighbors again? And it's been really successful so far. So much has changed so quickly, not just because people get to speak together about facing a similar problem, but also because these mental health workers really model the kind of behavior that they want everyone to understand, that it's okay to visit survivors. It's okay to walk through the village. In fact, you can walk hand in hand with them. And so that's what they're doing. They're going door to door, house to house, walking arm in arm with people through the community. And being able to see that is also making a really big difference.
Gina Moore, reporting from Liberia for BuzzFeed. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, Liberia's Ministry of Education has closed all the schools across the country to try to keep Ebola from spreading, and that leaves more than a million students without an education until the situation changes, and no one knows when that will be. That's just Liberia. Sierra Leone is in a similar situation with many schools closed throughout that country as well. Joining me now is Heather Simpson. She's Senior Director for Education and Child Development at Save the Children. And her group is working with both governments to help continue kids' education while the schools are closed. Hi, Heather.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you. One of the ways students are continuing their studies is through radio broadcasts. Tell us about that.
That's right. So schools are closed right now, but we want to make sure that children still have the opportunity to learn. And radios are something that people are using in their homes. And Save the Children's working with ministries of education in both Sierra Leone as well as Liberia to develop programs and air those programs so that children who are at home can listen to lessons on the air. And keep learning, because we know history tells us that once a crisis like this forces children out of school, many of those children will never return to school. And they're at a risk of becoming exploited or in child labor situations in the future. So what we're trying to do in the immediate term is use a tool like radio to continue lessons, so that children, even when they're not going to school, can continue learning.
Okay, and we have tape of one of the educational broadcasts from Sierra Leone. This is a clip of tape from a math lesson.
Get ready your exercise books and pens as we go through the lesson. One, convert 1 0 4 is 5 to base 2. We first convert 1 0 4 is 5 to base 10. 1 0 4 is.
And Heather Simpson, that seems like a really tough way to learn.
Yes, what you hear is a teacher doing a narration and doing a lesson. And if you can imagine what children in these countries, that is a sound that they're used to. That's the voice of a teacher. That's the cadence that teachers use when they're talking about lesson plans. And so usually children will be sitting in a classroom and they'll hear that same type of instruction. And so they're used to hearing those things. So this is actually a really nice way to connect children to the sound that they're used to in their classrooms, as well as the content. Children in Liberia and Sierra Leone will understand the words that he's using and understand the accent more than you and I can understand.
Yeah. So maybe it's also comforting just to hear a familiar voice like that. Do you know if students are actually taking advantage of this service?
Yeah. So what we're doing, we're working with the ministries of education to make sure the radio programs are aired. We're also working with mobile phone providers to try to do some of that monitoring to see what kind of impact these lessons are having. And so the mobile phone providers, we're working with them to send out messages, text messages to family members to get feedback on what the radio lessons are, how they are for their kids. And we're also making sure that children have some kind of reading materials. So supplemental readers, storybooks that have key questions in them to help children continue to develop their love of reading, to continue their comprehension, and also things like art supplies, because we want to make sure that children also have something that brings some joy in the midst of this really dire circumstance that they're living in. Schools usually would serve that role, where children could go to a safe place with teachers they know and trust, do fun things like play with their friends, do art, read, do math. All of that brings joy. And with schools closed, that part of children's childhood is shut down right now. So say the children's trying to work to figure out how to get these types of learning materials into children's homes so they can continue doing that.
All right. Heather Simpson, Senior Director for Education and Child Development at Save the Children. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on the program, why Uber is experiencing some discontent among its drivers and some passengers, too. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Uber drivers here in LA and in San Francisco staged protests this week over declining pay and over their working conditions. Meanwhile, drivers in New York and London actually went on strike. It's just the latest turmoil for the on-demand ride service. This year has also brought fights with taxi unions and local governments and a price war with competitor Lyft. What are the drivers demanding and what does this all mean for consumers looking for a cheap ride? Catherine Rampell is an opinion columnist at The Washington Post, and she's been looking into these very questions. She's here now. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, what are these protests about specifically?
Well, in many of the cities where Uber drivers are unhappy, it has to do with declining pay. There's basically a price war that's going on between Uber and many of its competitors like Lyft, and that price war is largely coming out of the wages of their drivers' pockets because, you know, the drivers work on commission. So the commission has stayed the same. So their pay has gone down. Many are upset that they're not allowed to receive tips. They're upset about other terms of their contracts that Uber is sort of able to unilaterally change and that sort of thing.
So what does a typical Uber driver make?
You know, it depends who you ask. Uber will say a number that is far higher than the numbers that I've heard from drivers whom I've interviewed about this. You know, and the other reason why it's difficult to come up with a ballpark number is that these are not standard employees. They're independent contractors who set their own hours. They can decide to drive 100 hours a week, and indeed Uber has incentives that encourage them to drive as many hours as they can, or they can drive an hour a week if they really want to. So it really depends. You know, one driver that I spoke with in LA, who's actually a driver for UberX, had put together a spreadsheet in which she looked at how her income comes out per hour when you factor in the commission that's paid, various safety-related fees that she has to pay to Uber, as well as, you know, sort of maintenance costs that the IRS estimates. I think it's about 56 cents per mile. And it came out to about $4.30 an hour, which is pretty low. And that, I'm sure that's at the low end, but it just gives you a sense of how unstable these drivers' incomes can be.
Yeah. And so I guess it's the same with the other companies, Lyft, Sidecar.
I'm sure it varies depending on the actual driver contract. I know a little bit more about Uber's terms just because I've seen those contracts before. But yes, it's highly variable.
All right. And so we're seeing a little crack in the facade there, at least on the driver side. What about on the consumer side, though? How do riders feel about the service these days?
I think it really depends on who you talk with. I think there's a lot of enthusiasm from many riders in cities where the taxi industry has been dysfunctional for many years. You know, there's this sense that, oh, look, I can see where the car is. I can tell when it's arriving. There's a critical mass of drivers around. It's become much more reliable and much easier for me to get a taxi or its equivalent today than it was several years ago pre-Uber. And beyond that, you know, it's cheaper in many cities. Uber has been touting the fact that they cost less than a taxi ride. But on the other hand, you know, there are concerns about safety. There have been a few high-profile incidents in which drivers affiliated with Uber have attacked passengers, not to say that that doesn't happen with any other company or industry, but that's gotten some bad press. And I think consumers might also have some concerns about other safety aspects, like what are the insurance requirements? I think there's been a bit more attention paid to that recently than there was maybe a year or so ago.
Right. And there have been really high profile battles here in California and elsewhere around the world over that very issue.
Yes, absolutely. Uber and the other companies as well, I should say, have fought pretty hard to change the way that regulations work in terms of, you know, what they're allowed to charge and what kinds of insurance the drivers are required to carry. In some cities, you know, they basically don't carry any commercial insurance, but it's not clear who bears the liability if there is an accident. In some cities, Uber has been working with the government, the local regulators, to try to come up with some sort of compromise so that they're not actually subject to the same kinds of regulations that their peers in the taxi industry are subject to. But it's something more than just, hey, I have personal insurance, and yet I'm running this business on the side. So there's been quite an evolution, I think, but it really depends on the city. And in every city, they have different regulations. And in every city, I would say Uber, Lyft, and Sidecar and the others actually fulfill those regulations to various degrees.
Now, you, though, have doubts about Uber's long-term viability, at least in terms of providing a cheap ride. And why is that?
Well, my concern is that we're in a price war now, which makes the whole industry look very appealing to consumers. Like I was saying, you know, you can see that the cars are reliable, they're around, and they're cheap, which is very nice. But part of the reason why we're having this price war is that these competing firms realize that there's a very high value to network effects, that if they can be the sole provider that kind of muscles out their competitors and they control, you know, they run the app that everyone turns to, then they, you know, they really win out, because you kind of need a critical mass of both riders and drivers for the company to be viable. And as soon as you muscle out a competitor, even though it looks like there are no barriers to entry, it's very difficult for an upstart to really make it, because they just can't get all the drivers and all the riders to appear at the same time. So what's happening is there's this very fierce competition to just grab as many consumers, as many passengers as they can. But the end goal, presumably, is that, you know, there's going to be one man standing, one company standing, and that's likely to be Uber, the way things are going now. And then their incentives will become very different. You know, they will no longer have an incentive to keep prices as low as possible once they have so much market power. Hmm. And again, that's not to say that other companies can't come in, and I think that's the argument that Uber makes. Oh, look, it's a free market. We're reducing barriers to entry. But it'll be very difficult for an upstart to actually come in and offer lower prices if they can't get that critical mass of consumers and drivers to show up at the same time. So that's what I worry about.
So it'll turn into just a regular monopoly is what you're worried about, and then the prices will inevitably rise.
Yeah, and actually, if you look at the history of the livery industry, we've kind of gone through these cycles before, that many cities, like in the 1920s or thereabouts, finally started regulating their growing taxi and livery industries at the time, you know, setting insurance requirements, having licensing requirements, that sort of thing. Over the next two or three decades, things started to get more bureaucratic, and there was a lot of frustration with the way that the taxi industries were run in many of these cities, you know, not for the benefit of consumers, the quality wasn't good, that sort of thing. And then all of these cities deregulated, like in the 1950s. There's a great law paper, law review paper about this. So they all deregulated. It's kind of similar to what we're seeing now. You know, they said, okay, we're not going to have medallions anymore. You know, the caps on the number of drivers out there. You know, we're going to change the insurance requirements. We're going to change the way that we set prices and let them set prices on their own. And it looked really good for a while, but then in a few years, prices went up. there were problems with traffic. There were problems with insurance, all sorts of things. And then they all re-regulated.
Yeah. That sounds like an age-old story. Yeah. So we'll have to see how that plays itself out. Catherine Rampell, opinion columnist at The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us today.
Good to be here.
Well, are you an Uber driver, and how has it been for working for the company? We'd love to hear your story. So give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, how 19th century spiritualism gave rise to the Ouija board and why it's still popular more than 100 years later. So popular, there's a new movie out about it. That's after a news update with Larry Perel.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Reviews for the new horror flick Ouija have been scary bad.
You ever feel like even after someone you love has died, there's still a way you can talk to them?
As friends we've gathered, hearts are true. Spirits near, we call to you.
Hey, this is freaking me out. I'm done with this.
Here's the official description of the movie. A group of friends must confront their most terrifying fears when they awaken the dark powers of an ancient spirit board. Well, the Ouija board isn't ancient, but it is older than you might think. As far back as the late 1800s, seekers have been gathering around Ouija boards to communicate with the other side. You just put your fingers on that small heart-shaped planchette and wait for the spirits to spell out a message on the board covered with letters, numbers, and the words yes, no, and goodbye. Whether it's a mystical oracle or family entertainment, the history of the Ouija board is about as mysterious as how it works. Robert Murch has been researching the story of the board for 20 years. He's a collector and historian of Ouija and other so-called talking boards, and he's here now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Well, first things first, is it Ouija or Ouija?
Well, originally, it was trademarked and pronounced Ouija, but by the 1920s, people were saying that when they played the board, they were Ouija-ing. So either or.
Okay, good. Well, I've been saying Ouija, so I'll stick with that. And where did that name come from? Because it's spelled like the French word for yes, oui, with the German word for yes, ja, J-A. So is that where it comes from?
No. We thought for many years that it had, but a couple of years ago, I found some letters from the originators of the Ouija board, all telling their parts of the story. And according to them, their record is that one night in April of 1890, a woman named Helen Peters, Elijah Bond, who patented the board, and Charles Kennard, who claimed to invent it, asked the board what it wanted to be called. And it spelt out O-U-I-J-A. And when they asked what that meant, it said good luck. And so they began to market this board as Ouija, the Egyptian luck board.
Huh. Okay, so this appeared in the late 19th century?
Yeah, so talking boards are the class of board games, and Ouija, or Ouija, is actually a trademark that's been in continuous use since 1890 and is currently owned by Hasbro. So Ouija is a brand, and talking boards are what these games are. Talking boards pop up in 1886 in Ohio.
Okay, and this capitalized on the whole craze for seances and spiritualism that took place beginning, what, in the middle 19th century?
Right, so the early spiritualist movement in the United States, and which spread back to Europe, is about 1848 with the Fox sisters. And this was some girls that were hearing strange noises in their house, and they began to communicate with them. They would ask for answers, knock once for yes, twice for no. And the early Associated Press, you know, covers this and explodes across the world. And suddenly everyone is making contact with the other side. And then you have the Civil War, where there's just massive death in the country. Everyone loses a father, a son, an uncle. These people just go away and don't come back. And so death is such a part of people's life that they begin wanting to talk to the dead. And talking boards leak out of the spiritualist movement into pop culture in about 1886. And then in 1890, they start making the Ouija board, and with some mass marketing, it just explodes.
So why did that one explode, of all the talking boards?
It's timing, brand, and story. So fads always have to, everything has to line up perfectly. And for the Ouija board, they were making this board before it had its name. Once it had its story that the board named itself, and they called it the, you know, Egyptian luck board, suddenly, you know, this company in 1 year went from one factory in Baltimore to two in Baltimore, two in New York, two in Chicago, and one in London. So they were able to put one of these boards in almost every house in America. And combine that with the timing, it's like lightning.
That's amazing. And what's also amazing is its staying power. I think people still have Ouija boards and they still play the game. And obviously, there's still interest. There's a movie out today.
That's right. So people often ask me why, almost 125 years later, the Ouija board is so popular. And I always say, well, because for $19.99, you get an unlimited calling plan to the other side. No roaming, no overages. So we're the same animals we were 125 years ago. Death is something we haven't conquered. In fact, we deal with death much worse than they used to back then. Back then, you'd have 12 kids, six of them would die. You would take photographs of your dead children with your live children so you would remember them. Loss was so pervasive in your life that everyone just dealt with it. Today, we do everything we can to stop death, slow it down, get around it. And so we're very uncomfortable with death. And because we still don't know what happens when you die, the Ouija board is a cheap, easy, accessible thing to try to explore that.
Okay. And we still don't know how it works, right?
Well, scientists believe it's something called ideomotor response. And that's that your subconscious is really making your hands move, though you don't know it. Because you want it to work, because you believe it might, your brain plays this game on you, and your hands always move a little bit. That's what scientists say. People who believe that you're talking to something else other than you or your subconscious believe that you are making contact with the other side or something else.
Yeah, something else. And it was considered a benign game until the 1973 film The Exorcist came out.
You really don't want me to play, huh?
No, I do. Captain Howdy said no.
Captain who?
Captain Howdy.
Who's Captain Howdy?
You know, I make the questions and he does the answers.
Well, looking back as a historian, we see that marker. So something changes in how it's presented in the movies. People from the beginning thought it was bad. There were lots of cases where people claimed to go crazy, that they killed people because the Ouija board said long before the movie. But what happens in that Exorcist movie is the people filming it decided to have the little girl play the game by herself, and then we know she becomes possessed. And so slowly this pendulum or the scale starts to tip where, as though there were a small segment who thought it was bad and everyone else just thought it was fun, all of a sudden it starts to look as if you play this, you could be possessed by a demon. And that starts to catch fire. So it's not a overnight thing. It's a slow building thing that was already tipping. And probably that's why they used it that way in the movie.
But also, I can imagine that made it even more attractive to young people.
Of course, you know, according to Parker Brothers at the time, when I talked to them before they were, you know, part of Hasbro, were that sales skyrocketed after that movie because they say that, you know, we know kids want to do whatever they're not supposed to. So they want to see their friend's head spin around and spit up split pea soup. That's what happens in the movie. They want to see their friends do that. So,
well, so where are you on this? Do you think that it is some kind of strange communication with the other side? Or are you on the scientific side?
I'm a skeptic, as I think everyone should be. We shouldn't just believe things that we see or touch or feel. You really have to think about this. And because belief is such an important part of the Ouija board, you should step back. But I will say this. You know, the reason why people play this is because everyone has lost someone suddenly. You didn't get your closure. You never got to say goodbye. You never got to say you're sorry. And so if it's possible to talk to the other side. Why wouldn't something like the Ouija board work?
Has anything really weird and spooky happened to you when you play it?
Not while I've played, but I have researched, written, and I have met, traveled all over the world to find the real story of the Ouija board. What really happened? Where did it really come from? So the strangest thing for me is that the story is still being told 20 years later. And when I started looking into it, the Ouija board was in one of its kind of lulls where people just didn't think or care about it too much. And so it's amazing to me to see, you know, 20 years later, there's a movie.
So you saw it last night, the movie. What'd you think?
I did. I loved it. I thought it's going to scare a lot of people in a good way. There were some jumpers. I always think every movie should be even more scary, but they left it wide open to a sequel, which I hope we see.
And what do you think it's going to do for the game?
I think it's going to do great. You know, Parker Brothers bought Ouija from the Fold Company in 1966. And in 1967, the Ouija board did something no game has ever done before or since. It sold more copies than Monopoly.
Huh.
Monopoly is the king of board game sales. I think you're going to see this really spike because the paranormal world is so big. We see every television station has at least one paranormal show, including Animal Planet. So I think this is going to put that back in, you know, younger people's hands. They're going to start exploring it.
Robert Murch is a collector and historian of the Ouija board. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great. And everyone should go out and see the movie.
Okay. And if you want to read more about the Ouija board, there's this great article in which Robert Murch is featured on the Smithsonian website. It's called The Strange and Mysterious History of the Ouija Board.
Ouija board, Ouija board, Ouija board, would you help me? Because I still do feel so horribly.
Morrissey, and the Ouija board. Hi, Warren Olney.
Hello.
What's up at 1 o'clock?
We are going to be talking about the practice of women who want to freeze their eggs when they are younger so that they can delay pregnancy until they are older. It's raised a lot of questions. There's new technology that makes it easier. It's become available for a lot of people. There's argument about the marketing of it and also about what it means in terms of male dominance of the workplace. Are women being pushed around?
Mm-hmm.
Should there be more help for family leave and child care and things like that?
Have it all. What a concept. Okay, Warren Olney to the point at 1 o'clock. A fascinating discussion as always. Stay tuned for that. And coming up on this show, our favorite husbands are here to weigh in on a dark comedy about marriage and other new movie releases. Stay tuned for Alonzo Duralde and Dave White next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Today's movie segment brought to you from the beyond by Hasbro. That's right. We're not done with Ouija just yet. But wait, there's more. Keanu Reeves, Edward Snowden, and Alpine Avalanche. Alonzo Duralde, chief film critic for The Wrap, is here. Hi, Alonzo.
Hello.
And Dave White, film critic for Movies.com. Welcome back.
Howdy.
Howdy. Okay, let's talk again about Ouija, however you want to pronounce it. It's a spooky board game. Here's a clip.
Is there something you want to tell us?
Sarah, cut it out.
I'm not pushing it.
Who is this? Sarah, if that's you pretending to be Debbie, then that's really messed up.
I swear it's not me, all right?
Okay, this is freaking me out. Let's just stop it now.
I'm sorry, let's just put your hand back, please.
Okay, so as I said earlier in the show, this has not been getting great reviews.
What?
I know. Shocking.
I know. I single-handedly rescued this movie from being a Rotten Tomato, a 0% on Rotten Tomatoes yesterday. I felt a little weird about that, but because I don't want to be in the position to defend Ouija because it's a silly movie,
yeah.
But it's not boring, and it's, you know, it's pretty much a movie. It's a horror movie for young kids, but for tweens.
It's extremely scary.
It's PG-13.
If you're nine, and you're at a slumber party, it's gonna
keep you awake late.
It's not The Exorcist, though.
No.
No, but it steals a tiny bit from The Exorcist and steals from all kinds of other horror movies.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Scary R-rated horror movies, but diluting it all down into a kid-friendly sort of package. So, like, Paranormal Activity and Sinister and Insidious and The Conjuring and...
You name it. Anything of the last 5 or 10 years.
Little bits and pieces taken from all these other films and... kiddified.
Yeah. Even in that clip you just played, you know, at the end there was a dung. Ah! The dung is the key thing for a PG-13 horror movie because they really can't get away with much blood or gore. So there's a lot of like dung. You know, they open the door and somebody's there, or you know, the cat comes out of the closet, or whatever.
Those things really scare me.
Those can be startling. They get annoying after a while, and there's a lot of them in the first third of this movie. But then once the plot kicks in, there is some genuinely kind of spooky stuff that isn't just about dung. So that's, you know, I thought it kind of picked up. And, you know, there's at least one kind of clever plot twist. So, I can't hate this movie.
No, there's not. If you're an adult person who has seen a horror film in your life, you will not need to see Ouija, whatever it's called. Yeah. If you're, again, 9, sure. And
9-year-olds should
level,
have horror movies.
9-year-olds should have horror movies.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have Are You Afraid of the Dark on TV anymore. So,
Goosebumps.
Kids need things. Kids need to be
so
scared.
So it's really that benign.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much, yeah. But again, I've seen much worse of this ilk. And so, you know, the fact that I had...
One missed call, those haunted cell phone movies,
for instance.
That was pretty good.
You know, so the fact that there was a mild entertainment to be had, I will give you credit for that.
Okay, next up, a shoot 'em up thriller starring Keanu Reeves. It's called John Wick, and here's a bit from the trailer.
I lost everything. That dog was a final gift from my dying wife.
Jonathan, you got out once. You dip so much as a pinky back into this pond, you may find something reaching out to pull you back in.
It's personal.
It's always personal, isn't it?
It's incredibly personal this time. John Wick is played by Keanu Reeves, and he is a hitman in retirement. And he's such a good hitman. They call him the boogeyman in Russian, but what they really call him is... the guy who goes and kills the boogeyman. You know, so he's badder than a badass. And his wife dies in the first, 2 minutes of cancer or something. Mm-hmm. And then she's so thoughtful that she posthumously mails him a dog to help him grieve her. And then these Russian mobsters come and kill the dog and steal his car. That's
so
not a spoiler.
Now it's personal.
Yeah.
Big time.
That dog is cute. Like, you get 5 minutes of this adorable beagle puppy and then, boom, murdered. And John Wick goes
on. And that's enough for motivation for the whole
rampage.
2 hours?
Oh, yeah. It's 90 minutes because, honestly, there's nothing going on in this movie at all. It is absolutely unnecessary and useless and ridiculous. But boy, is it fun to watch because Keanu Reeves, as the film tells you, is very angry. Keanu Reeves never really expresses anger very well, but he has a gun. He shoots off and stabs. He also has a knife. All the faces of everybody.
Hmm.
It's lots of fun. I mean, if violence
and the plot is
your...
just revenge for the dog.
Mm-hmm.
That's it?
Yeah.
And the car.
Car, too.
Right.
But more the dog. Like, you, the audience, are more attached to that sweet little doggy. and you're like, you know what? 83 people should be killed because of that dog's death. And so if you don't like violence and it's extreme violence, then stay home. But if you're awesome, you're going to have a good time.
Plus, it's got Willem Dafoe in it, Ian McShane.
Yeah.
So some good character actors there.
All of whom who die.
You just ruined it for me.
I know. I'm ruining it for everyone. Everyone dies except Keanu Reeves.
Okay. Let's move on to the documentary Citizen 4. This is the Edward Snowden documentary. We talked about it on the show yesterday. Alonzo, you call this movie one of the most unsettling thrillers of the year.
Yeah, I think we all sort of know the Snowden story and we had some understanding of what he was revealing, but this movie really kind of breaks it down in a way that as somebody who sort of follows the news, was kind of like, oh, it's that bad. It's there's this many people now on the watch list, you know, and when it gets past a million, you have to wonder, okay, that's a lot of watching, you know. And what's really great about the film is that the director, Laura Poitras, really just kind of doesn't feel the need to throw in animated graphics and, you know, a lot of the stuff that documentaries like to do lately, these sort of, you know, little, you know, montage bits to kind of keep you interested. It's very spare. It's very just kind of fly on the wall, observational, these conversations that Snowden is having with Glenn Greenwald that, you know, became such giant news. And just the secrecy involved in getting to the point where they could even have those meetings in the first place is so cloak and dagger because, you know, he's trying to stay underground. She's already on the NSA watch list because of these previous films that she made. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very kind of creepy film about the times that we live in and what's, as I said in the review, you know, what's being done to us in the name of what's being done for us.
Now, this is an issue that in real life hasn't really excited the imagination of the U.S. public very much. People in many surveys don't seem to care that much about the NSA spying mm-hmm. story. Yeah. Do you think that this movie will cause people to take a second look?
No.
No. I think the people who already don't care are probably also the people who don't go see documentaries.
So you would recommend going to
see it? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no. It's a very powerful film. I think people should check it out. I just wish that the people who should see it would see it. I hope it's a film that provokes discussion and kind of brings back, you know, it was very easy to sort of get lost in the how dare Snowden do what he did and reveal that information and those classified documents. And that's not the interesting part of the story. I mean, the interesting part of the story is what's in those documents and what are we learning, you know? And as we know, the media, after the first wave of the shocking revelation, the second wave is, oh, this person who made the revelation, he has, you know, overdue taxes and cheated on his wife and blah, 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 blah. You know, forget Edward Snowden. It's what Edward Snowden told us that we need to be talking about.
Right, which we have been talking about in the news media for many, many, many months.
If only Carlton could come up with a choreographed routine about this for Dancing with the Stars, the whole world would know about it. It would go viral. Yeah.
Or maybe if Edward Snowden could be on Between Two Ferns.
Bingo.
Yes.
With an adorable cat in his lap.
Okay. All right. Let's move back into fiction. And the last new release we're going to talk about this week, Force Majeure. It's about the aftermath of a non-fatal avalanche in the Swiss Alps.
Papa! Papa!
Papa!
Okay, it sounds scary, but it's actually a comedy. It's a Swedish comedy.
Yes, it's a very dark comedy. it is probably the most uncomfortable date movie since Gone Girl. it's about a married couple and their kids, and they're on this ski vacation. And seemingly everything is ideal and wonderful, and they're great, and they've all got matching parkas, you know. And you get little hints of, oh, maybe he spends too much time at work or on the phone. But then this avalanche happens, and while the mother sort of protects the kids, the dad goes running. And that blows the lid off of everything. Everything that's wrong with this marriage, everything that's wrong with this relationship, suddenly now is brought into great relief. It's sort of like if you took the guy in the Poseidon Adventure who shoves somebody else out of the way so he can climb up the Christmas tree and then dies anyway. If he lives and has to deal with the consequences of the shoving, that's what this movie is about. And it's so wonderfully awkward and... You know, he at first is sort of denying that it ever happened, and then finally she has the footage on his phone to prove that it did, and it's just this slow unraveling of all these other marital discontents that all get brought to the surface by this one, you know, doozy of an inciting incident, as the playwrights say. It's a really terrific film. I think it bobbles a little in the last 5 or 10 minutes. They don't quite know how to end it, mm-hmm. but for so much of the running time, it is such a high wire of grimacing, like laughing through clenched teeth kind of stuff. It's definitely worth checking out.
In his defense, kids weigh a lot. And to have one strapped to your back while you're trying to outrun an avalanche is burdensome.
And you do want to take your phone first.
Yes.
Because, you know, if you haven't paid for Apple Care, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so what would you guys do? You're married. An avalanche comes. Let's just you know, role play here. Who's running and who's staying?
Well, we don't have children.
Right.
So we could.
Well, let's
you
say
know,
you had a cat with you or something.
He would live and I would die. And the reason for this is
John Wick's puppy. You
he
could
moves,
have that.
Yes. He moves so quickly. He's a fast person. And I am like a tortoise. and I don't go
anywhere quickly. I like to think that I would throw Dave to the floor and shield him with my bulk, but, you know, who knows? Who can say? That's the whole point of the film. Until it happens, you don't know how you're going
to
react.
Avalanche places require getting in probably a very small plane to get to. That's why I'll never be in this situation.
Avalanche places. I like that. All right. From the safety of the studio, that's Dave White, film critic for Movies.com, Alonzo Duralde, chief film critic for The Wrap. Together, they host the Linoleum Knife podcast. Check that out. Download it. Listen to it. Laugh. Learn. Love.
And we'll, maybe this week we'll have avalanche tips.
Okay. Yes. Thanks, you guys.
Happy pre-Halloween, Madeline Brand.
Thank you. What a great way to end a great week, Julie Myers.
I am here with the feedback, but first, in the Ouija versus Ouija debate, a final word.
It's pronounced Ouija board.
So Dave White has ruled. Sorry, everybody.
That is the best drop ever.
Well, we asked you all about your Ouija board memories just in time for Halloween. Irene Guzman on Facebook says that she used to play with a Ouija board with her sisters and neighbors when she was a kid. Well, Irene's mom insisted that the kids shouldn't be messing around with that stuff. It was not all fun and games. Well, the Ouija board started to spell out really creepy stuff and threatened to kill one of her sisters. And that was that for Irene. See you later, Ouija. Anthony Hernandez says he had a Ouija board when he was a kid. His highly Catholic grandmother called it an instrument of the devil, but Anthony says he's pretty sure Hasbro isn't beholden to the devil. He'd love to play around with a Ouija board again. I was going to play the drop again.
You were?
Mario, undermine me. Okay, we're done. Okay. We're done. I'll put it on Monday.
It's pronounced Ouija board. There. It's my impression. It's a terrible impression of Dave White. Julie Myers, thank you so much.
Of course.
We are out of time. Thanks for listening this week, you guys. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.